Figured you knew her.
Morning.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Morning, Commissioner Irving. And welcome to the February 5, 2015 meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission. Will you please join me in the pledge?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Chairman Chopping, we need to take the roll, please.
Thank you. Madam Secretary?
Commissioner Harrison?
Here.
Commissioner Meyer?
Here.
Commissioner Campbell?
Here.
Commissioner Irving?
Here.
Chairman Topping?
Here. At this time, we're open for comments on items not on today's agenda so that speakers can be properly identified for the record. Please complete a speaker slip form. Available in the back of the room and hand it to the commission. And also, please state your name and if you so choose, your place of residence. And please limit your comments to 3 minutes. I have a speaker slip under this item from Eric Greening. Mr. Greening.
Thank you. Good morning. I am Eric Greening. And The setting for these comments, the immediate setting for these comments, has to do with the board meeting of the county supervisors this Tuesday, status update on various countywide water programs, in which case the following previously proposed programs, policies, and ordinances they determined would no longer be pursued. Water neutral new development, agricultural water conservation offset, a water waste prevention program, retrofit on sale expansion policies, water supply study preparation mandate for land divisions within an LSOS-3 groundwater basin. All of those basically hit the floor. I think our focus, given that they apparently are leery of imposing new sorts of requirements on people that they have not faced before, our target for water conservation now should be to remove incentives for the unwise extraction and use of water. And so I think the first place we can go, one that sticks out in my mind like a sore thumb, is our agricultural cluster ordinance. That contains a huge incentive for bringing land under cultivation, whether the cultivation under irrigated cultivation, whether that irrigation is sustainable or not. And this can be remedied by simply putting one word in a few key places in that ordinance. That word is existing. It should be only for the clustering of existing parcels. That goes with the initial intent of containing the antiquated parcels and making their development more rational, or giving an option where it could be made more rational. But right now, you can create parcels that have never existed by essentially increasing the building entitlement on an agricultural property. With grazing land, you get one house per 160 acres. With irrigation, you get one house per 20 acres. Those imaginary entitlements can be turned into lots that have never existed and then clustered. And so one gets an eightfold increase in the buildability of one's cluster and what can be built in one's cluster by putting land under irrigation, even if it's not agriculturally sustainable. Just having it there at the time the cluster is approved is enough to get the eightfold increase in entitlement. That hole needs to be plugged. Please take a look at this. Thank you.
Thank you. We're ready for planning staff updates.
Right. Good morning, Ellen Carroll.
From the Planning Department. I have some information for you on your future meetings, and just please remember that all of the information that I'm giving you about these items is tentative until we actually see them on your agenda. But in general, your next meeting is February 26th, and at this point we have two hearing items. We have time for the Renewable Energy Streamlining Program if your commission doesn't finish that today. And then we also have a winery project, which is in the North Templeton area, the Niner Winery Project. And then there will be one, at this point, we have one item on consent, which is a lot line adjustment. No, it's a general plan conformity report, excuse me, in Napomo Hermerick Properties. So the next meeting date after that would be March 12th, and at this point we have one hearing item on that date. It's the Santa Margarita Cemetery General Plan Amendment Project. The next meeting date after that, March 26th, we have three hearing items tentatively scheduled. Turley Winery in Paso Robles, Harbor Terrace, which is a project in Avila, and then also the Villa San Juliet Winery project in Paso Robles area. So that was for March 26th. I will go one more date out, but notices haven't been put together yet, and this is really tentative. We have the potential for the Guadalupe cleanup haul route project to be on your April 9th hearing. That's in Napomo. And that's all I have at this point.
We greatly appreciate hearing not only when, but what.
Sure.
The extra effort is appreciated. We understand that these are basically tentative until
right.
fixed on the agenda.
Right. All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Kara. Ellen. Next, we will go to item 3 on the agenda. This is Halter Properties. Madam Secretary, Ramona, would you be kind enough to announce this item?
Yes, sir. Hearing to consider a request by Halter Properties, LLC, for a conditional use permit. County file number DRC 2013-00051, Supervisorial District 1, Holly Phipps, Project Manager.
Before we begin, do any members of the Commission have any ex parte context to report?
Yes, I visited the site with the applicant's representatives yesterday, a couple days ago.
I didn't have an official visit, but I know it well from several visits prior.
All right. Staff report.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the Planning Commission. Holly Phipps, Project Manager. Before you today is a request for a conditional use permit to amend the existing winery and uses within the existing structures to allow an increase to their special event program, to increase it to 25 special events with up to 200 guests. They would like to add a second tasting room, a farm stand, a kitchen, restroom, and changing rooms. The proposed project may result in 0.25 acres of site disturbance on a 952-acre site to allow for a leach field expansion if needed. A conditional use permit is required for several reasons. The first is the increase to their special event program and a request for modification regarding the size and design standards of the farm stand, which I will discuss later. The proposed project is located in the agricultural land use category and is located on the north side of Adelaida Road, approximately 8 miles west of City of Paso Robles. The site is located in the North County Planning Area, Adelaida sub-area. Here we have an overview of the site plan. Up here we have the new wine processing facility. It's approximately 40,000 square feet. With that, they have approximately 20,000 square feet of wine caves. They can additionally build approximately 4,000 more caves. They have a new primary tasting room, 7,500 square feet being constructed in this area, estimated completion is 2016. They have an existing wine case storage barn buildings here, approximately 3,000 square feet. Here we have a closer look of the project site. So down here we have the existing 920 square foot tasting room. This tasting room would be converted into the farm stand and a second primary smaller tasting room within this structure. Up here would be Event Barn 1. Overflow parking is located here. Event Barn 2. And then we have the silos, which would be converted into changing rooms and restrooms. Behind the silos, we have the wine press building, which would be the commercial kitchen. So as I mentioned earlier about some modifications, the applicant is requesting a modification of the ordinance to allow two tasting rooms. The second small tasting room, 280 square feet, this section here, would be for wine club members where they could come and taste, and it would also be where they could come and pick up wine for club pickups, wine club pickups. The primary tasting room, as I noted, is 7,500 square feet that was previously approved under a previous conditional use permit. Land use ordinance states that one tasting room is allowed but can be modified through a conditional use permit. The applicant is also requesting modifications limiting the floor area of the farm stand to 500 square feet to allow 640 square feet. A modification limiting the floor area to 50% to food grown on site and to 50% of food grown off site. Additionally, limiting the farm stand to 50 square feet for prepackaged food to allow the entire farm stand to be dedicated to prepackaged food not grown on site. The proposed 640 square foot farm stand is incidental to the primary use of the site on the land, which is growing wine grapes on the 200 acres of land, processing these grapes in the approximately 60,000 square foot wine processing facility where they produce 50,000 cases of wine annually. Additionally, the farm stand would be located in an existing structure. A conditional use permit may be used to modify the limitations on site design and standards. This is just showing that they do have secondary access, and the primary access is located here. Staff has presented you with some revisions to the conditions of approval. On page 3-13, condition 5, where it says 25,000 cases, we'd like to replace that with 50,000 cases. And then we'd like to add a new condition on the last page, page 3-16 of the staff report, to add toilet facilities, and it would read as follows. Portable restroom facilities may be used in lieu of permanent restrooms, provided they meet all state and local specifications and are sufficient to serve the maximum numbers of persons allowed at an event. With that, staff is requesting adoption of the mitigated negative declaration in accordance with CEQA based on the approvals of the conditional use permit, based on the findings listed in Exhibit A and the conditions listed in Exhibit B, and based on the corrections submitted by staff and read into the record. And staff is available for questions.
Do we have any quick questions that the commission would like to ask?
A couple here.
Okay, let's see. Mr. Irving, you had your light on first.
Holly, clarification on the change of cases of wine, was that just that you had the incorrect number at the beginning, or is this an increase over their existing permit?
Both. I had the incorrect number. The previous conditional use permit back in 2005 did not set a limit of maximum case production, but in the staff report it did allude to anticipated case production of 25,000 cases. Since 2010, they have been producing 50,000 cases, as stated from the Regional Water Quality Control Board.
Okay. And the other question I have is regarding to this change on the toilet facilities using portable in lieu of the permanent restrooms. Is that limited in time? Since the application is to convert the silos into changing rooms and restrooms, is this just a temporary fix or?
No. It would... it's not anticipated that the restrooms that they will be installing will accommodate all the guests for the special events. So like we've done with other special events and temporary.
Okay, so I think you got you answered me there. The portables would be used for special events, not to replace the application for the conversion of the silos into restrooms. Thank you.
Commissioner Campbell.
No, that was my question about the portable toilets. So got answered.
All right. If there are no further questions from the commission, Commissioner Harrison.
In your ERR, it says this is a very high fire hazard area, yet in a later place you indicate that it's not. How did you change that?
Well, I do not know the answer to that question. They should be consistent. I can look at the CAL FIRE letter and see what they stated in their response as to what the...
So it was in a very high fire hazard area.
I'm sorry, I'm having a hard time hearing you.
They said it was in a very high fire hazard area.
Okay.
But then in one of your places, it's in your mitigation, it says that you had mitigated that, and I just wondered how you did it.
CAL FIRE has a fire safety plan that they have to submit and then adhere to all those fire safety plans to mitigate any fire concerns that they have.
I understand the mitigation of fire concerns, but I don't understand how you got it out of the very high fire hazard severity zone.
You could still be located in this classification. Obviously, I missed.
That's okay.
So in that regard, we can let the record show that it is a very high fire hazard severity zone.
That's what it says.
Area, yeah. And then the other thing is the secondary access. You showed us that. Could you show us that again?
This is existing, and the fire letter said that they are good with this secondary access and primary access.
That's actually the access by trucks to the winery, so it's a,
it's
a good road, so to speak, is my point.
Your point?
It's more than just an access. It's a good existing road to the winery. Is that
yes.
not correct? Yeah.
Thank you.
And the other thing I didn't understand is how converting the tasting room into a farm stand and then building a larger tasting room reduced the water usage.
We were looking at the water uses currently used for the 920 square foot existing tasting room. So when they bumped that down to a smaller tasting room for just the club, wine club members, that water is reduced because it's not the full tasting room.
I understand that, but then you're talking about building another tasting room that's twice as big.
And that was already approved in 2005, and the water concerns were not an issue, so we're not changing.
I understand that now. That's all.
Okay. Would the applicant like to? Ms. Pickens?
Yes, good morning, Chair Topping and fellow commissioners. My name is Mandy Pickens with Kirk Consulting, and I'm representing Halter Ranch Winery this morning. I did prepare a presentation, but as I know, you have a full agenda on your plate today, and we feel that staff has covered the modifications and requests today, and we concur with the recommendations, et cetera. I'm available for questions. However, I did just wanted to make a couple points that, you know, the intent of this application is to, you know, the case production has grown, their wine club membership has grown, and so they're seeing the need to expand their hospitality opportunities on site, and in doing so, keep with the historic character and quality of the site that we all know out there, with the adaptive reuse of the existing structures. And yes, there's a couple of modifications, but we feel that those are within the intent of the ordinance, and they are minor, and we feel it makes sense to have something like a farm store at this location where their two collector roads meet. Gives opportunity for locals and also visitors that are coming out in those rural areas to purchase something for picnics or take home and cook with those local products. And just the ability to modify the percentage will give them a little more flexibility in the types of products that they provide on site, whether that be things that they grow, fresh fruit or nuts, et cetera, and then also things that they might be processing in their proposed kitchen as well as other local products nearby. And other than that, that second tasting room, yes, it's something a little new, but we feel that that's really convenient for the wine club members to be able to go in quickly, make their orders, pick up their shipments, and not have to go up to the main tasting room where the general public is. And with that being said, I'm available for any questions you might have.
Mr. Irving.
Mandy, the existing tasting room, which will be converted, or part of it will be converted into the second tasting room, is there going to be a division that separates? I mean, basically, you're taking the existing room and cutting it by a third or thereabouts. Is there going to be some sort of physical barrier between the two?
There is not proposed. They're just proposed to be removing the large portion of the tasting bar, which will open that area up for the retail proposed. And then there's a little curve in the bar that portion they're retaining to have the cash register there and a person available if members do visit that.
So how does the public know that this is not for them?
That's a good question. As part of the application, we've also proposed a new signage program that will direct visitors up to the main tasting room and those that wish to visit the farm store, so that signage will be available. And all the signage proposed in the signage plan is all compliant with LUO standards.
Another question that I have, a couple of issues with, or questions. The rationale, I mean, the idea of farm stands is that it's to produce locally or on-site grown products for the public, and that's, I think, contained within the ordinance definition of what a farm stand is. I'd like a better rationale as to why you in particular, or Halter in particular, should be allowed to expand beyond the ordinance on that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I understand your question. They do want to have the opportunity to have their on-site local products or products that are on other sites leased by them. But they also would like to have the flexibility to have other local growers' products to be on-site. And when the ag retail ordinance was written, they did provide those restrictions to encourage the percentage to be grown on site. However, they also provided a section to modify those standards in these type of situations through a conditional use permit, and that's what we're asking for.
Okay. Other questions? Commissioner Meyer.
Actually, it's not questions, it's comments, so I'm not asking you to stand there and witness my comment.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, we can wait.
Sure. I had a question. Are these the fancy kind of porta potties, or are they the?
I'm sorry. What was that again?
Are these the fancy kind of porta potties, or the basics?
It's really up to the applicant. I believe, just knowing their taste and quality out on site, that they'd be presentable. And really, we concur with that recommendation because sometimes we have conflict with building code and the amount of restrooms that are required to be permanent for assembly uses, but these aren't always ongoing. And so they wanted to limit the amount of site disturbance on site rather than build a whole new building with permanent facilities. They wanted the ability to bring in the supplemental porta potties and still meet the intent of the building code. The
reason I asked was because I've been to large events, for example, in Avila, where they have the fancy kind where you can actually wash your hands.
Mm-hmm.
And for health reasons, I would think that would be desirable.
I agree.
Okay.
I think they agree, too.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Any other questions, comments? I think that's all we have for in the way of questioning.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Commissioner Meyer, you had a comment you wanted to make.
Do we have any papers?
Just Ms. Kirk and the applicant.
We still have to open.
Of course. My colleagues remind me that we need to open it for public hearing. Is there anybody that would like to make a public comment on this item? If not, then we can go back to the commission.
So I'm familiar with the site because as a child I used to visit it with my older sister who's now passed away. And we would have picnics out there because it was relatively an abandoned site. And I remember it pretty well, and I remember the little rundown house. And that Carpenter Gothic house is actually one of my favorite houses in the North County, and you guys have done a great job in restoring it. I, like Commissioner Irving, I had some worries about the farm stand idea for the same basic reasons you do. But then if I turn my hat around the other way and pretend I live out there in that neighborhood, I'm pretty excited about the idea that there might be something available to buy besides a bottle of wine or a tomato within Adelaida / Vineyard Drive. And then I'm thinking, after that, I turn my hat around again and go, well, wait a minute, what if every winery in the whole North County wants to develop a mini market? And so we're going to be selling chips and soda out of all these facilities. And I'm all I can come back to from that discussion is, well, the caliber of this particular installation, in my opinion, is very high. The people have done a good job on this. I keep staring at you because it's your district. They've done a great job with this vineyard and this installation. And it's also it's at an intersection of two key roads, an arterial road, and that's part of, I actually called Holly about this, and because of its location on an arterial, it's not at the end of the road. This would never happen on the end of a dead-end road. It can only happen in an area where there's a certain amount of traffic and it's an arterial. So I'm a little bit, my fears are a little bit allayed by that. And so the other thing I like about it is it's not a new building. And so it's an existing building. They're just trying to make use of their existing, and rather than putting up an artificial wall or something. And so I'm kind of like, well, I don't really want to start a test case that makes an example and everybody else jumps in, but then she also mentioned, well, it takes a conditional use permit to get that, and so not everybody in the county wants to go through the expense and time and effort of creating, of doing the conditional use permit just for a little bit more square footage.
So if I could comment back to you on that, there's two things in this application that and what we see coming, and to use a popular term, mission creep. And as you just said, I'd hate to see this be now used as a reason why, I mean, within a few miles of this, there's numerous other wineries, and I'd hate to see a continued expansion. And my other concern is the development of the commercial kitchen, which I can understand for special events. But as you know, we have coming before us a request for a restaurant at a winery, and we've had that in the past, and I'm starting to see this pattern of, well, we want to get a commercial kitchen, and then we want to come back, and then we want to get a restaurant, and now more and more we're expanding out further and further out into the country with full-blown commercial facilities on agricultural land that is not zoned for that. So just there's a little concern. I will agree with you, however, that this particular applicant has already demonstrated incredible commitment to the historic nature of the property and all of that. And I just kind of wanted to voice those concerns because I think whether it's this commission or future commissions, I think they'll look back at this and go, oh, well, you guys allowed them to modify the farm stand requirements, but a little person out on El Pomar Road who operates a farm stand who can't afford to go through the commercial, the cup process, is going to say, but what about me? I want to survive, and the farm stand is really important to my little 5-acre plot. It's less than important for Halter Ranch, selling 50,000 cases of wine. So there's, I'm torn with setting precedences all the way along that other commissions where we would not have had this conversation may not look back at it. So I'm going to be interested in hearing Holly's justification for this. But thank you for your comments. I've gone back and forth on the impacts, the location, and therefore. So
I always try to put on my county planning commissioner hat rather than my district planning commissioner hat. If I put on my county planning commissioner hat, then I think, well, the county is a tourism economy, right? And so if you're out in Adelaide, you can't get a sandwich at this time. So in my opinion, it'd be kind of nice maybe to be able, and yes, it is a little bit against our ag the zoning and the Williamson Act and all that kind of stuff, but does that mean it has to be forever, or should we be evolving, or should we not be evolving? I don't know if it's an evolution. This is a discussion. It's not that I'm right or anybody else is right. It's just like, what is San Luis Obispo County now that it is what it is now? It's not what it was 50 years ago or 100 years ago. Where is it going to be in 50 more years? And if we're trying to fill our hotel rooms, what does that take? If we're trying to,
Yeah, but let us not forget the residents who live along these roads, who see the, right. who bear the burden of the increased traffic.
Right.
And already Vineyard Drive is.
I'm not necessarily arguing for. I'm just. Yeah. I'm just debating it.
Yeah. Well, I tend to like side in the favor of the community. However, in this case, the community has not commented anything negatively, and probably. The neighbors that I know would greatly support it for a lot of the same reasons you stated. Anyway,
maybe there's a way to condition with some other kind of condition that tempered the fear somehow.
I don't think so.
Okay. So then my only other comment is that I'm in support of the separate restroom temporarily. I think there may be some language in there about temporary, only for the temporary events, the portable restrooms, so they don't just live there on a trailer day in and day out, and I don't know if that's in the language that's been drafted, and then we went into the little silo. We opened the silo, and I'm going to suggest that you guys might want to put some soundproofing in one of those silos if you're going to have a restroom in there, because they echo.
Let's see. Before we go to staff response, let's hear from Commissioner Campbell.
Yes, on the portable restrooms, this is very much commonplace, Commissioner Myers. In fact, I'm in charge of ordering them for our ag tour, and the ones we usually get are very nice with hand washers and sanitizers, et cetera, in them. So it's the thing you do when you have events. And if you have one event following another one weekend after weekend, they just may sit there from week to week just so the company doesn't have to pick them up and re-deliver them. They come out and service them and leave them in place. I, too, would like to compliment the Weisses for the job they've done with that beautiful Smith/McGillivray home and facilities there, and the fact that they're utilizing, I wouldn't call them silos because it wasn't a dairy, they're probably their grain storage tanks, but at any rate, I'd like to compliment them for the job they've done. And a little rationale, and I understand the concerns of the other commissioners, and I carry some of them in the future, but a little bit of the rationale, being in the wine business ourselves and belonging to several wine clubs, it seems to be the trend. We're finding it in a lot of the wineries that have the room to put a VIP section. Wine tasting has become so popular in the North County. Those that go to the trouble to pay the price to join the wine club kind of don't like to be shoulder to shoulder at the counter tasting wine. And so having something to eat, cheese, whatever it might be, sandwiches, etc., kind of falls in line with the VIP, if you will, or separate tasting rooms for wine club members. It's very nice to have some family visiting, as we've had, and to be able to go into that room and have special treatment. My daughter works at Edna Valley Vineyards, is in charge of that room, and the room's always full of people with their relatives visiting, et cetera, and they have kind of a private place to meet and be served some hors d'oeuvres, et cetera, and it's really a nice way to go. So that's the trend I'm just trying to capture here for the future as we discuss the perhaps limitations in the future on this. That's all I have.
Would staff like to comment or respond on the mission creep issue?
Well, we do see things changing. The industry's changing. The ordinance does state that you have to be within a mile of an arterial collector. They're within two. The size that they're requesting, the allowed is 500. They're only asking for 140 square feet over what is normally allowed. Part of the reason those conditions, it's hard to regulate when, it's supposed to be for food grown on site and stuff like that. So you may have that as a condition, but that's hard to regulate. Not going there. But also it allows them to be open year-round, so that they don't have to close the farm stand by allowing them to not be limited to just growing their food on site. And as far as the conditions for the toilet facilities, at the end of the condition we could add and shall be removed after each event, if you'd like.
I don't. If these guys have a lot more experience than I do on that sort of event, I'm willing to defer to their opinion.
Commissioner Campbell's point is well taken. If they're back-to-back events, yes. So it's hard to say after each event.
Yeah, exactly.
But on the other hand, they're not asking for that many events. There was, didn't I see some? There was a comment about, you know, 25 special events. So if the toilets are tied to the special events as opposed to industry events or industry-wide things, I'm not sure. 25 special events, Holly, is not referring to, not including the industry-wide right. events, right? I don't know. I haven't fully thought that one out.
You know, the more I think about that, it feels more like I'm meddling. And I'm willing to
costing the people some money because they're going to pay to pick them up and take them back the next Friday.
No, you guys are right. And it's their property. They're going to be making their own property ugly with their. It's not my property.
Yeah.
Nobody else. It's going to be out. Good. I presume the toilets are going to be a location out of the view shed of the roadway.
I would expect them to be placed over there by the silos and tucked away.
Given that, it's a non. Yeah. Kind of a non.
I do want to talk to Public Works about the collection fee, which we ran into with Adelaide Sellers project recently. So, first of all, the question, Frank, is you picked a peak hour of, I think it was Friday afternoon. Is that, first of all, is that the same time frame that was chosen for Adelaide's determination of peak hour traffic?
Yes, it's the same time.
Okay.
It's based on measurements we've taken and at the intersection. That's the peak hour for there.
So that's the for the left turn lane on Lake Knox Meadow Drive. Is there any? Are you Public Works concerned about Vineyard Drive, because this property really is serviced not just by Adelaide Road, but I would venture a guess that it probably gets majority more traffic off of Vineyard Drive. Is there any additional concerns we should have about Vineyard Drive?
No, I don't think so. The impacts to Vineyard Drive are accommodated by the Templeton Road fee.
Do they have to pay into the Templeton Road fee? Because
no.
They're really served by both, even though they front onto Adelaide Road. I mean, Vineyard Drive is right across the street from them.
The presumption is that the Templeton Road fee area was set to cover all of the traffic that is reasonable to anticipate on Vineyard. So if we look at development along Adelaide Drive, as you get closer to Knox Meadow, you would expect all or at least almost all of the traffic to come from there. At some point, as you get closer to 46, you expect most of the traffic to come from along Vineyard Drive. We have to do a cutoff point, and that cutoff point is there at the end of the Templeton fee area. So,
which ends at the terminus of Vineyard Drive?
Plus or minus, yes. I mean, I'm envisioning where the cutoff line is, and it's about there. But that's what we had to go with. So, if we had reason to believe that there was significant traffic from this project generated in that direction, then we would have to look at the Templeton Road fee. But we don't believe that to be the case.
Do you revisit those fees and those cutoff traffic points at any interval? Just speaking from practical experience, I see more traffic on Vineyard Drive, east going whatever it is, north-south, in-town, out-of-town, than I do on Adelaide Road.
So on the Templeton Road fee program, we're required to look at it at least once a year. And so we do a minor look at it every year about December. It goes before the board, and we give a status of what's happening and what we anticipate to happen in the near future. Every 5 years, we do a major update, which we basically look at the whole thing from scratch.
Mm-hmm. And at that five-year period, is that where you could change the boundary of what is of the properties that are subject to the road fee? You couldn't go, in other words, let's say that you were on your five-year review next year and they've built this additional facility and they have a consequently or subsequently a increase in business, and you monitor that road and you're discovering an increase in traffic on Vineyard Drive, can you modify your road fee and then go back and say to this property owner or, say, Tobless Creek, by the way, you guys have to contribute into this road fee, or is it only when a project comes before them, before us?
The time to ask a question is when they come in for a building permit.
Mm-hmm.
Then we look at what are the road fees that are applicable that day, both what are the rules, what are the dollar amounts. The Templeton road fee first went into effect, I believe it was 1991. We've had several major updates. That line hasn't moved. It's possible that that line could move, but I wouldn't expect it to.
Yeah. So really, we're the tail chasing the dog here in that as all of these wineries along Vineyard Drive and Adelaide Road contribute to an increase of traffic, we're not seeing the income from those wineries or a portion or fee from those wineries being collected to help maintain or improve the safety of the roads. It seems like we're one's behind the other.
You're saying that the building permit may not be.
Yeah, if they build all this, maybe they don't need to come in ever again.
Yeah,
and that's a structure. That's not our job to change that. That's the supervisors. But it seems to me that's an antiquated way of looking at things.
But I think there is notwithstanding the merits of this project, which are quite fine, I think Commissioner Irving's comment needs to be somehow noted for the record, because it is a moving target, and if the industry is morphing and the conditions are changing such that that the standard approach to projects in the future, which raise similar questions, may not be germane to the conditions as they change. And so, Mr. Robeson, is there a way to flag this concern? And I think the commission serves several functions. It serves as a sounding body for the public, but it also serves as a future advance-oriented board, which flags issues as they begin to appear as an early warning system.
Thank you, Chairman Topping. Bill Robeson, County Planning. So the question is whether or not your commission can flag certain items and have them kind of surface with the board and have more direction given to staff.
How do if we see an issue emerging, how do we draw it to notice?
I think our department takes notice of your comments. We start to look at them. Although a more formal process would be your commission, writing up a memo or some kind of a document to forward to the board.
Sure.
So that the board could give our department more direct and official direction to start researching this issue.
Okay.
I would be in support of our chairman drafting a letter with staff or having staff draft a letter that you approve.
I think we need to look at it, because as we've seen with many winery projects and different things, not just Adelaide, but before that we had Wild Coyote, and we've had a number of projects along that and as you said earlier, the whole nature of the county is changing into more of a tourism business, and I see roads falling behind while they're being asked to handle more traffic, and now you've got the whole bicycle issue with the 3-foot and no shoulders, and those roads out there are really popular for the bicycles on their blind corners, and it's just like a matter of time. Mm-hmm. And I'm going, we need to get ahead of this trend, or at least get equal with it in some fashion. So I would be in favor of a request to the supervisors or staff in any way to start addressing
this. If I could add, I wouldn't want to discourage or encourage you guys to write a letter if you see a need to do that. However, if you just tell me it's a short walk from here back to the office, we can make sure that we're addressing things well as far as transportation on that road. So far, your comments are already noted.
Thank you, Frank.
I might add that kind of you mentioned off the cuff, if we look at this next year for Templeton, well, it turns out next year is the time that we do the major update. So we can address this. We will base it on what the planning department has put for the general plan. We won't assume something greater than that or less, but we do have to estimate what will the development be, and that'll be based on the general plan.
Go ahead.
The other flip side, I'm a cyclist too, so I agree that that's an issue. However, I also think that the nature of these rural roads in their, if they start becoming these wider arterials that get too wide, then it changes the character and flavor of the neighborhood to some degree. And so it's a much larger discussion than just public works. It's got to be, it's more of a, it's a question for this committee, and it's a question for the supervisors to try to decide.
Yeah, do you add shoulders? And I don't see the county widening roads, but at least currently Vineyard and Adelaide in this vicinity are in really good condition. But then conditions change. So that's all. I think we've killed that topic.
Commissioner. Yeah. By the same token, the public brings up comments periodically. Like Mr. Greening just this morning brought up a comment, and I don't know the answer to his comment, but I think it's worthy. Sometimes those comments are worthy of being brought up to the same sort of level. The idea that he brought up earlier with respect to cluster housing and water, something I never thought about before, and something I'd like to think about in the future. And so, how do we bring that forward as an agenda item? That's something. Actually, I think that topic, I would suggest maybe even should be, and topics like that, we need to come up with yes, that's a good idea. We agree we should re-agendize that for the future and then let staff come back to us with times that's on the agenda so that we can take it to the next level.
We have traditionally in the past held study sessions for idea exploration, and I'm sure that would be another avenue for exploring an issue like this. Commissioner Campbell has been very patient.
I was just going to say there's one thing that we haven't discussed before we get writing memos and getting too upset about this is that, you know, there are wineries such as Wild Coyote that was done several years ago. Adelaide itself was done several years ago. It would be very simple for Mr. Honeycutt to see what the level of fees were when Adelaide first built, and then what the level of fees were with their new addition. If there's a difference, then this one-year and five-year thing must be working. I don't know. If the fees have remained the same as they were since 91, then I can understand this concern.
Yes, well, the program has some flexibility, but as noted, the fees come after the building is built, and the improvements come after a number of buildings are built. We're doing what we can to keep up, but it's not a perfect system.
So are there any further comments or questions from the commission on this particular item? We've noted, hopefully for the record, that there is a change going on in the industry, and that some of our commission members are mindful of the potential longer-term implications of this, and we'd like to have an opportunity, I think, at the earliest feasible time to perhaps further explore this, maybe in a study session at some point this year. But does that make sense?
Yeah. I have another question for Holly here.
Yes, sure.
Holly, the letter from the Ag Department raises some questions about that I kind of alluded to earlier about precedence, and also is the project consistent with the rules of procedure for Williams and Act? Maybe I missed it, but could you review for me why it is? I mean, did Mr. Waller review this project and find it consistent with Williams and Act?
Yes, Terry and I did discuss this project. When looking at it, we found when it first came in, the museum was not consistent with the rules of procedure, and so they took that out of the project description.
Okay, and that was as far as the expansion of the use of the farm stand from beyond the ordinance requirements to allow the non-farm or non-site produced goods to be sold. The committee didn't have any problem with that.
It didn't go to the committee. Terry just reviewed the project.
Thank you.
In that regard, perhaps we may want to include the Williamson Act implications in future discussions, since the Williamson Act is allowing for people to have their property taxes reduced, which other members of the public then have to supplement. So
we look at our ordinance of what is allowed in agricultural land use zoning category, and these are allowed uses, and the revisions, modifications are allowed uses through a conditional use permit.
Okay.
And to add to that, there's no crop production area being decreased. So the fact that they're using existing buildings, as the agent said, that makes the the Williamson Act process a lot easier to adhere to.
Okay. Well, I'm ready for a motion.
I will move that.
Before you make a motion, can I just
go jump?
What sinks into me in this whole conversation more than anything is your comment about the 5-acre owner who can't afford to have a conditionally to go through the process to, and who could really use the income and what that means. And that discussion in my mind, I don't know if I have any further discussion there, but it just really suddenly sunk into me. Like, wait a minute, here's a party that can afford to do this and is willing to take the time and energy and blah, blah, blah. And therefore they get it, but everybody else is just going, wait, what about me? That's a really interesting comment. And I don't know how to respond to that, but I think that's probably the most important comment today.
Well, thank you.
Those are the folks that are struggling, that are maybe on the edge of their financial capabilities or something, and so I don't know where to go with that.
Maybe we address the definition of farm stands down the road.
We can add that into the conversation for a future discussion.
That said, I move that we approve the conditional use permit DRC 2013-00051 based on the findings listed in Exhibit A and the conditions listed in Exhibit B as modified to the $50,000 and the use of the portable toilets. 50,000 cases.
Yes. Do we have a second?
I will second that.
Okay.
If I could jump in, I'd like to just clarify the issues that you'd like our department to bring back as far as discussion items for your commission. One has to do with the road maintenance road fees in the area of Vineyard and Adelaida, which Public Works is probably the best department to answer that question. But we can partner with them, give you more information on that. The other piece was how...
Mission creep.
Mission creep and how, wineries are evolving into asking for more kind of retail uses than what's normally allowed in the past. But they can do it through a conditional use permit. But you're asking us to kind of look at that and see what the implications are of that?
Sure. And then it's just that generally we're looking for an opportunity to discuss this absent an individual case that might be unnecessarily impacted.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll take a look at that. And then the last piece that, Chairman Topping, you mentioned was the farm stand issue, and we can present the information to your commission on those three things as soon as we can get that all together.
Great. Is there any discussion on the motion? If not,
Chairman Topping, may I please have another iteration of the motion? So that I could get it for the record, was it including condition 27 and condition 5, and is this
it
study
is
session topic or not?
No, it does not include the study session topic. That was inserted parenthetically, but it is the modification of condition 5 and the addition of toilet facilities under condition 27.
Thank you. Commissioner Irving?
Yes.
Commissioner Campbell?
Yes.
Commissioner Harrison?
Yes.
Commissioner Meyer?
Yes.
Chairman Topping?
Yes. Okay, with that, our next item, before we start in, would the commission like to take a breather, or should we go straight forward? Okay. Staff ready for?
We will get there.
Okay, good.
Hearing item number 4 is a continued hearing to consider a request by the County of San Luis Obispo to amend portions of LRP 2014-00015, county file number same, all supervisorial districts, project manager James Caruso.
Okay. Since this is a complex item involving multiple changes to the county code as well as an EIR, I'd ask staff before we go proceed with the details of the staff report to please outline the general order of topics today and this morning, and also to suggest when the commission might wish to take public comment on this item. Meanwhile, if there is anybody who plans to speak on this item, the Renewable Energy Streamlining Program, I'd remind you to get your speaker slips into the commission. Mr. Caruso.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission. James Caruso with the Department of Planning and Building. So your handout I gave you is also up on the screen this morning. It's the order of hearing topics. As the chair has mentioned, this is a complex program with changes to the general plan, land use ordinance, rules of procedure, and an EIR. So we have are suggesting the order of the hearing topics today to keep things in line. Commissioner Topping, we've just flipped a couple of things since the last time you and Mike Wilkins spoke. Oh, and by the way, Mike will not be here today. He's ill. This is second to last day.
Oh.
So.
Well, I think it might be nice to pause for a moment and just reflect that Mike is retiring. Is that right?
Correct.
And has served the department long and well, and we wish him his best in his retirement.
All right. Thank
Absolutely.
You Absolutely. So the way we would like to proceed today is to first respond to some of the issues that were raised at the last hearing, and this is the sort of the way we've done it, the hearing process up to now. Look back at what the issues to discuss in the last hearing. Then Bob Stark, here to my left, is the EIR project manager, and he'll give us about 10 to 15 minutes on the draft EIR, and the discussion topics are right there. We'll take a look at the impacts in each impact area. We'll review the Class 1 impacts. And Bob will spend some time on those comments and the responses to comments on the EIR, and then, of course, the changes that we're making to the draft EIR to create the final. And then finally, if we have time, we can go back through after the commission's questions and discussions on the EIR. We can go, perhaps if we have time, go back through the page-by-page review of the RESP. So, Mr. Chairman, if you would like, perhaps after the discussion on the draft and final EIR would be the time for public comments, because we would have had both the discussion of the issues from last week already done and the comments on the draft. Gives people, I think, more topics to testify on.
So that would be between the second and the third main bullets. Okay.
And that's a suggestion if
okay. I think everybody's comfortable with that. Okay.
All right, great. One of the things we want to review one thing, because we haven't talked about this since the study session on the 8th, is why are we creating the RESP? And there are five important reasons, and we need to keep these things in mind. And the first reason is, remember, the state has a renewable portfolio standard that's soon to go up to 50% renewables by the year 2030. And this streamlining program is something that the state of California, of course, has funded for the county to do to streamline this type of development. Locally, however, and perhaps even more importantly, is the county's own general plan in the conservation and open space contains a program, this exact program. This streamlining program was put into that element several years ago, and the what you see before you is based exactly on the wording in that general plan policy and program. It's also repeated in the county energy plan that was just adopted about 3 years ago. And something that we haven't talked about before, but it's actually included in the board supervisor's legislative platform to happen at the state level to streamline renewable energy development. And then lastly, as part of the grant from the California Energy Commission, the program description and what we have been funded to do is pretty much exactly what is before you today. So there are the five reasons why we're creating the RESP. And I think it's important to keep in mind that the policy has already been established. This is the policy of the county is to streamline renewable energy development. And I think the focus of attention is going to be how are we going to do that and to what extent we're going to do that. All right. So we're going to quickly go through, hopefully no more than a couple of minutes, on some of the issues that came out of the previous hearing. The chair had asked about what type of public outreach has been done. For this RESP, fairly standard public outreach that we do with most long-range projects. We established interested parties lists. Nowadays, there are email lists. We also send information at various points in the process, such as the initial referrals, the notice of preparation, the draft EIR, and now Planning Commission hearings to all of the advisory committees in the county. Not only the community advisory committees, but also the subject advisory committee, such as Ag Liaison and Water Resource Advisory Committee. We also have a separate list of city planning directors that we send those periodic updates to, once again, at the key parts of the program process, such as notice of preparation, availability of the draft EIR, and each one of the Planning Commission hearings. Have not gotten much of a response from the advisory committees or others. We've met with the City of San Luis Obispo. They were interested in some aspects of this. We have met a couple of times with the Ag Liaison Advisory Board, and the only advisory committee, I shouldn't say the only, but the advisory committee that's interested in this, and we will be doing a presentation for them again, is TAG, the Templeton Area Advisory Group. And that's coming up next week. The second aspect, a second issue that came up last time was what kind of lessons were learned with the construction and the monitoring on the large solar projects and on the eastern part of the county. We had a meeting with the staff of the department who's been dealing with the monitoring and the construction management of those projects for quite some time. And they were rather careful as to what lessons that were learned. Some of it is still up in the air. But the general things that they said was certain things such as dust impacts were greater and was more difficult to control than they had originally thought they would be. The second thing is probably the most interesting finding is that there was very good mitigation to impacts on sensitive wildlife. However, a lot of those populations have what they call crashed in the area. However, most biologists say, well, that's due to the drought. So what we're going to have to do is we're going to have to wait until we get some decent rain and then they'll be able to make a determination, a scientific determination on the impacts to the populations out there. They were also very surprised at how well the setbacks and screening actually screen these large facilities from Highway 58. It was generally noted that when the road is on the same elevation as the facility, it's pretty easy to fence and screen. However, when you have different elevations is when it gets more difficult. We're going to have a picture of that. And that also that in spite of the fact that there was not supposed to be much lighting, as it turns out, there is a little bit. And in a very dark rural area, it stands out. So they're going to have to address that in the post-construction phase. And most of it is because they do some work at night, and they bring in large lights to do that. The small solar projects are perhaps a better example of what we can expect. Remember, those four small projects were all around a megawatt or less, all would be represented by Tier 1, less than 20 acres of solar. We have some pictures of these. That's the Jardine project over on Nacimiento Lake Road. It's up on the hillside. It's the Nut Ranch property. And I have to admit, I went past this once because I never saw the panels. They're not very visible. And unless if you're driving, you have to look at a 90-degree angle when you're going west. When you're coming east, they're a little bit more obvious to the to people driving on that road. Interesting setup. I don't think I've ever seen these types of panels, that they're pods like this. So if we take a look at the next one, this is Finley. This is over by Commissioner Campbell's house, not too far. The lower picture in the lower right-hand corner is taken at the elevation of the road, so you can see when there's a difference in elevation, it's tough to screen these things. And I think I have a couple more here. Once again, elevation from the road in the upper left-hand corner, right at the driveway in that lower right-hand corner. You can tell the site is a little bit higher than the elevation of the road, maybe about 5-6 feet. One of the interesting optical illusions, and I don't know if, Commissioner Campbell, you ever noticed this when you drive by, but when you look at this facility on edge, it almost looks like vineyards going up the hillside. In fact, I did not know where the site exactly was, and when I first saw it, I said at that perspective, I didn't realize they were solar panels. We've got some representations of wind, and these are small wind. They're not local. These are residential applications in the two upper pictures in the lower left. More common are commercial applications of wind. That's lower right in a looks like a suburban office building lined with small turbines. We don't have much of this type of facility in the county up on rooftops. We just don't have that much wind.
There's some in Morro Bay on top of, I think it's either Culligan or
it's commercial application.
Right down there by the old A&W, the main street. And
it's not a residential application.
Correct, it's commercial.
Okay. That was it for the follow-up on issues from the last hearing. We wanted to move into
James. Just a quick question on the visual elements of the large solar projects. Were those panels using I see the requirement for non-reflective panels.
I assume they were because it's a standard on everything.
Okay, so that's not something that's changed. I just don't remember hearing that phrase in describing those projects. I see Don Legg in the audience, who works for First Solar, might be able to answer that. No, shaking her head. So, I mean, I see it in these small projects,
right.
And so I'm going, well, is that just the new description, or has the technology changed so that because the large projects out there, I remember that was a great deal of concern, was the visual impact of glare from that. And I remember a neighbor showing pictures of the test plot at First Solar and all of that. And so I just was wondering if you had any further.
I'm, Commissioner Irvin, I'm not sure on the large projects. As you noted, the small projects all have that same condition, that
right.
the panels be non-reflective. We see, and that's actually a standard in the RESP
okay.
for all solar Good. Electric facilities.
Thank you.
I'm thinking that we'll have time, hopefully, for a robust question and answer session.
I was just going on so, at the moment.
I just wanted to mention that since I have a number of questions too. So we all do perhaps. So what we'll try to do is to we're coming up on break time. How long do you anticipate the EIR review might?
I can be brief.
Oh, okay. So about 20 minutes, 10, 20 minutes?
Definitely less than 20.
Okay. All right. And then after that, we'll have a break, and then we'll see where we go from there.
All right. She said if not, I'm buying lunch, so I will hurry.
Take your time.
It would be my pleasure. Good morning, commissioners. So you've all...
Could you get a little closer to the mic, please?
Sure. You've all had a chance to... cover to cover, read the EIR by now, and I was intending to go page by page, but since we are on a limited time, I will be brief and do want to allow time for robust question and answer. I have about 14 slides. This is the first. I'm going to break the presentation into these four main components, talk about the project description and the project alternatives that were evaluated in the EIR, go into the impact analysis and the findings. That includes those Class 1 impacts that you're aware of. I'll talk about the final EIR and the components of that, namely the comment letters that we received in response to the draft EIR and the county's responses to each of those comment letters, as well as any revisions that were made to the draft EIR, and then talk briefly about the findings of fact and statement of overriding considerations, which is a critical piece of the administrative record for the project. Starting with the project description. Just skipped ahead one. There we go. Three main components to understand about it. One is the combining designation, the renewable energy combining designation maps themselves. The second piece is the streamlining eligibility table. The third being the what we called the related policy actions, such as the changes to the Williamson Act rules of procedure and other related policy changes to be consistent with what we are proposing in the program. Of those, as far as the EIR is concerned, this table that was included in the project description that includes the eligibility for the different tiers of projects. This is really the critical piece that we focused on for the majority of the EIR.
Can you help us find that?
Yes, that is in Chapter 2 of your EIR. I believe it's Table 2.0-1. But also, if you have the final EIR handy, there's a clean, updated version of it. So I think that is probably going to be, or actually, it's not clean. It's in strikeout version.
On page
2 also?
Yes, so Chapter 3 of the final EIR.
3.0.
The small document you have. That's, page 3.0-3. And that's the strikeout underline.
Thank
version.
You.
So with that table, you will find the different tiers of projects. Also included in the project description were characteristics of these types of projects. We want to know for a solar energy facility, ground-mounted, roof-mounted, a wind energy conversion system, roof-mounted, ground-mounted, what do these look like? What are the assumptions that we are basing our impact analysis on? So we included descriptions of each of these types of projects, not only in the table, but in a narrative in the project description as well, and included things like construction and operational characteristics. How long will these projects take to build? How many workers are required? What types of equipment? how much water is required to clean solar panels for any given type of project. These things are important for us to lay out in the project description because they are going to be the drivers of what the impacts for those specific projects are. If we know that there's going to be 10 construction workers that are required to build a 20-megawatt solar facility, we know that equates to a certain amount of cars that are driving back and forth to the site, a certain amount of equipment being used, air quality emissions, noise, et cetera. So that's laid out there. Now, those are the site-specific impact drivers. You then have the cumulative impacts of the project as a whole. And for that, we created what we call a build-out scenario. And what we did there is said, let's look over a long-term horizon, and if the county adopts and implements the RESP, what are we likely to see come of that? And through market demand, industry trends, available infrastructure, lots of other factors that went into a professional discussion, we concluded that a very conservative estimate would be 150 megawatts and 1,500 acres of total ground disturbance and total energy construction as a result of the streamlining program.
By conservative, you mean maximum?
Maximum. So all cases, when we prepare an EIR, we always want to err on a maximum side. If it ends up being less, we say, so be it. We're covered then. We've got our envelope of impacts. What we don't want to have happen is to underestimate things and then go, oh, shoot, we have to go back now and maybe reanalyze. We also have a requirement in CEQA to evaluate project alternatives. So we devised two alternatives in addition to the required no project alternative, which is listed as alternative 3 in the EIR. That's basically a business as usual. What happens if we do nothing and do not adopt the program? And that is your business as usual alternative. The two other alternatives were a limited combining designation scope. We basically limited the project to a maximum of 40-acre projects. So that's a substantial reduction in what would be allowed under streamlining with the proposed program. And the second alternative was a smaller footprint of the combining designation and really the program as a whole, and an all-out avoidance of important agricultural soils. As we'll discuss and as you're aware, we have a Class 1 unavoidable impact related to the conversion of agricultural soils, and we wanted to say, how can we propose an alternative that would completely avoid that? And that's the obvious way to do it. You say it's forbidden. So that was alternative 2. The way we go about devising and evaluating these alternatives, there's a rule in CEQA that says each alternative must achieve the main objectives of the program while also reducing or lessening some of the impacts associated with the program. So that's how we developed those alternatives.
I'd like to come back to that issue because I think I can think of a variety of permutations which
Sure, and I've anticipated that as well. We do have some flexibility. So if in the end the commission board decides, well, we like alternative 1.5, or we want to do some variation on this. As I explained, since we've been conservative with the EIR, a lot of our conclusions are very conservative, as long as we're within that universe, that is acceptable, and you can make variations on the program.
Okay, thanks.
Moving into the impact analysis and findings, as you know, there's no projects being proposed here. There are no site-specific development proposals before you. This is a program. These are policy changes. The program affects how projects would be processed in the future. So inherently, we have no direct environmental impacts. They're all indirect impacts and the cumulative impacts of the implementation of the program. We are tasked with disclosing what are the reasonably foreseeable impacts of the program. And that's an important concept because we can't foresee every single impact that might occur. And CEQA doesn't demand perfection. It requires that the county make a good faith effort at disclosing what the reasonably foreseeable impacts of the program will be. And so that's why it's important that in that project description, as I explained, we laid out for the record, here's what we're basing all of our impact discussions on. These are our assumptions. And then we moved forward into the impact analysis. It was an iterative process. I know James spoke of this before. We had a very unique opportunity with this project to be working on the environmental review and analysis hand in hand with the team that was creating the program itself. So when we were analyzing it, if we found that, I don't think we can conclude that there wouldn't be a biological impact or a cultural resources impact here, then they would say, well, how do we do that? I said, well, we need to have a requirement for a biological survey, and that's how those conversations got started, and that over time the program became evolved into what you see today, which avoids all almost all impacts with the exception of a few. We have no mitigation measures in the EIR, and I know that's a different type of concept to grasp. Usually you do an EIR because you have impacts and you require mitigation measures. In this case, because we had this iterative process where a project would typically have a mitigation measure, we were able to make it part of the project. So typically you might have a development proposal come in from a developer, and we are stuck with evaluating that development proposal and prescribing mitigation measures to it. You can think of this project as going back with the developers, sitting down and changing their project to make sure that there would be no impacts and no mitigation measures are required. So all of those performance standards are encapsulated in the program, and that's where the requirements are for the biological studies, for the cultural resource studies, for setbacks, for avoidance of all sensitive resources. These are the significant unavoidable impacts that are disclosed in the EIR: aesthetics and visual resources, agricultural resources, and land use and planning. With aesthetics, we do a lot to avoid what visual impacts there may be. We have height limits, setbacks, avoidance of ridge tops and other unique geologic features. All these are built in to avoid visual impacts. But as James mentioned with some of the projects and photos that he showed earlier, because of unique topography, elevation changes, and because this is a programmatic environmental evaluation, we can't know at any specific site how something's going to look. So a conservative conclusion is that there may be some projects that could occur that just may not look good to some people and may have visual impact. But we are avoiding the sensitive visual resource areas that are sensitive. All the known areas, ridge tops, we're avoiding all of that. There still may be some projects that could be visually objectionable. With visual, there's no bright line test there. And I guess that's a good way to, and what I mean by that is when we talk about biology, we can have a biologist go to a site and say there are species present, there are not species present. Yes, no, black, white. Visual resources is a little different because even if we were to have someone go out and do a visual resource study, there is still an inherent subjectivity to some of this, and anything that has subjectiveness and requires some review, and now we're getting into discretionary approvals and a discretionary evaluation, and we want to try to avoid that in the project. Agricultural resources. I mentioned the conservative conclusions. This is another area where we feel that there, although we have lessened and tried to avoid agricultural resource impacts, there may still be a small subset of projects that could result in impacts to important agricultural soils. The Tier 1 projects, which are those ground-mounted solar energy facilities that are 20 megawatts or less, that was really the remaining item that resulted in the designation of a Class 1 impact for agricultural soils. Even though they are restricted from being located on prime farmland, even though they are required to be located on disturbed lands, there still may be instances where even though it's disturbed and even though it's not on prime farmland, it still meets some of the other criteria that comprise important agricultural soils. And because of that, that would be where the impact results. So we think that's probably unlikely to happen. But again, we wanted to be conservative in acknowledging that it could. There may be instances of that. To mitigate for that, in some of the other Tier 2 and Tier 3 projects, there's a requirement for easements to basically compensate for the loss of those important agricultural soils. With the Tier 1 projects, that was a conscious decision that there would be no easement requirement because it would defeat the purpose of streamlining to require a property owner that wants to convert some of their property with solar facilities, such as with some of the winery examples, to have to go through the extra steps of putting an easement in place would really defeat the purpose of streamlining. You're adding additional layers and requirements and hoops to jump through. Finally, the land use and planning impact is identical impact to the agricultural resources impact. There's a question in CEQA on the list that says, in land use, would you convert any agricultural land uses to non-agricultural use? So that's the same thing. It's basically mimicking what we've already addressed in agriculture. And we say, yes, this is not only an agricultural resource impact, it's also a land use impact. Comment letters, we received 10 of them on the draft EIR. Mostly agencies, one individual, a couple of environmental groups. We had a couple of letters that were in support of the program. We had others that generally supported but had a lot of questions and concerns about the way it was currently structured. And then there was a couple others like FEMA and the Air Pollution District that just laid out their regulatory oversight of projects, and here are our standards and regulations that you must follow. So we just basically acknowledged those, but they weren't really in favor or opposed to the project. Comments really focused on a couple of issues, biological resources, ag, and visual resources. A lot of these comments we responded to and had to just basically be clear about a lot of things. It's a complicated project, and it's a complex EIR. There's a lot of material in there. So there was comments that said, it appears that you have just taken a radius around substations and plopped that on a map, and that's your combining designation, and you've given no regard to environmental constraints or environmental resources, and that's not the way to do this. So we had to respond, well, that's not the case at all. The combining designation maps, the first step was a practical consideration for where infrastructure is located, but that was just the first step. There were several other steps of overlaying sensitive biological resources, sensitive visual resources, so all these other constraint layers, and that's why it's not a perfect colored circle around on the maps. They're splotchy. There's only some areas within there so it was a lot of clarifications explaining that no, that's not the case. With biological resources, which was a very hot topic, we had to explain, yes, we want to be very clear. You must avoid sensitive biological resources. There is no allowance to impact them and compensate for them in some manner. If you have those resources on your project site, you are kicked out of the streamlining program and you can proceed with your project, but under the standard discretionary review practice. So some of those things I've hopefully helped clarify issues with a lot of the commenters. The only real remaining issue out there is the public review process and lack thereof with some of these new ministerial approvals for qualifying projects. That's something that probably can and should be discussed in further detail. technically it's not really an EIR issue. If we're talking about how the public, you know, from our perspective in evaluating this, we say, are there going to be biological impacts or no? Well, if you have a county-approved biologist evaluate the property, which is a requirement, and they must be county-approved to avoid any perceived or real conflict of interest issues, that's that. It doesn't matter from our EIR evaluation perspective whether a third party has had a chance to review it or not. Revisions to the draft, there weren't many. Your final EIR is not that heavy to carry around in your bag, probably, because there's only a few pages that have revisions to the draft EIR. There were no new significant impacts identified, no new project alternatives or mitigation measures offered or included, and those are really the triggers for when you may need to recirculate your EIR, and that's something that we do not have to do because none of those new significant information, which is the CEQA verbiage, none of that applies during this process. I'm going to go back to the comment letter slide for a second. Some of the issues that were raised in the letters caused another iteration of the project. So even at this phase, we had an iteration of the program and changes to the EIR. Fairly minor things, acknowledging some of those pollution district, APCD, dust control measures. We included those in the EIR. They're not new or unique to this project. They're already out there, but we wanted to acknowledge them. The inclusion of the rare plant lists that the California Native Plant Society had asked that we include. We've added that as an appendix to the final EIR to show and demonstrate, yes, these are acknowledged as sensitive species too. Agricultural resource standards and terms. Class 1 and Class 2 soils are now referred to as prime farmland. That's consistent with the conservation and open space language that the county uses, so we've replaced that globally. And the California Department of Fish and Wildlife submitted a letter, and they had some measures that they recommended. We've included some of those in the program. The wildlife fencing issue, Commissioner Irving, I think you were speaking of that the last meeting. And so we've said, yes, if you need the 18-inch clearance on the bottom and maximum height of 42 inches, we'll put that in there. That works for us. So some of those things were added to the program based on the comments that we received. And finally, the findings of fact. This is more of an administrative item that goes into the record of your proceedings. I would kind of refer to it as an EIR digest. It's a 75-page document that you have attached to the supplemental staff report. It goes through every single threshold and impact discussion in the EIR, and in a briefer 75-page document demonstrates why the impact would be avoided, lessened, and for any residual remaining Class 1 impacts, why those are acceptable to the county. So going to the final slide here. That acceptability of those Class 1 impacts is referred to as the statement of overriding considerations. And so the last two pages of your findings document, I believe, includes that statement of overriding considerations. And I lost my slide. But it's basically indicating that, yes, we have read all of the documentation. We understand the impacts, and we understand there would be some residual Class 1 impacts with regard to agricultural resources and aesthetics and visual resources. But when we take that and balance them with the benefits of this project, they are acceptable to the county. And that's a statement that you have to make in certifying the EIR and approving the program.
Thank you. With the commission's acknowledgement, I think what we'll do now is take a 15-minute break. And unless somebody has any questions that they really need to ask right now. Okay? All right, and we'll be back here in 15 minutes. Item 4 on the agenda, and we appreciate the staff input. Is there anything else that on the EIR that you want to add before we say open it up for public comment? If not, then I have several requests to speak on this item. First is from Eric Greening, and then followed by David Chipping.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and before going into some of the things I'd prepared, reacting to this news of population crashes of wildlife in Carrizo, one can call it drought caused, but it's the intersection between drought and the loss of resiliency in the affected populations due to habitat loss. And if you go forward with this plan, which you shouldn't, I would strongly advise you to remove the entire Carrizo from it, or you will have a howling severity of Class 1 biological impacts out there. That is a mecca for listed species of all kinds. That said, I look through your findings of fact, and a lot of them don't seem to be facts. They're findings of wishful thinking. Page 10, quote, "When compared to non-renewable energy plants, the greenhouse gas emissions reductions realized by the use of the potential SEF and WECS facilities allowed by the proposed program would more than offset the greenhouse gas emissions generated by the construction and operations." That would only be true if fossil plants were being shut down as a consequence of this program and as a consequence of the renewable portfolio standard in the state. And yes, they're going to get to a higher threshold in 2030, maybe, but it is still additive, not subtractive. There's nothing in there that requires a replacement of one means of generation by another. And at times, energy use has spiked, and it may again if the governor gets his bullet trains and who knows what else. That said, let's go to another one. Page 23. Construction and operation of ground-mounted SEF facilities could result in impacts to vegetation both on-site and adjacent sites through introduction of invasive weeds, overspray of herbicides, and dust-covering vegetation. That probably is a fact, and we're talking about vast areas of type conversion. The only thing I see thrown in, and I guess we're not supposed to use the word mitigation, is weed management plans, which none of the neighbors will see, and no one in the public will have a chance to monitor the effectiveness of. So again, I don't see that there's a finding of fact behind no Class 1 biological impact. Quote, "Key impacts to the species regulated by the California Department of Fish and Wildlife or the U.S. FWS that would require state or federal permitting is not eligible for streamlining under the RESP." That is not a fact. You've already blown a hole in this for the San Joaquin Kit Fox, and there is no peer review or public scrutiny of the surveys. They could easily be doctored. They could be done at inconvenient seasons for the wildlife. Anyway, there's so much wrong with this, I don't even know where to start, and I haven't even started, but thank you.
Excuse me, Mr. Greening, could you just give us those page numbers again, because you went by them very quickly.
I could give you dozens of page numbers to find things that aren't facts.
Is that in the supplemental staff?
I was on page 10.
Eric, is that the supplemental staff report you're reading from?
That's in the supplemental staff report, findings of fact. And, of course, what I described on 23 also blows in a hole in the overriding conditions. Page 10, page 23, and page 26.
Thanks.
I could find a lot more, but that was 3 minutes.
Thank you. Mr. Chipping.
Good morning, and thank you for hearing from me again. I'm David Chipping from Los Osos, and representing the local chapter of the California Native Plant Society. And we are in support of Alternative 3, which is no project. Although the state legislation and the raison d'etre of this is in changing the ability of the public to have input on land use decisions, there's no evidence that removal of peer review will slow down these multi-million dollar projects, which they are, as I pointed out last time. This appears to be a sort of grant-driven rush job, and the confusion mentioned regarding the program and, indeed, CMPS's first responses shows that it's an extremely confusing document and probably explains why there's been very little input from local advisory groups. As I mentioned last time, there is an existing 3-acre speed-up exemption in law that could be taken advantage of that would parallel a lot of the Tier 1 impacts. And if one was going to do anything at all with this, maybe Tier 1 okay, junk the others. In regard to peer review, the issue of solar plants came up in the Carrizo Plain, the existing ones. I would like to point out that when the draft EIR for the southern plant, I guess it's California Solar Ranch, was produced, it revealed that their plant surveys were done during drought. And due to protest in reviewing that, they had to go back and redo those biological surveys. Such failures of performance will be completely missed under the proposed program because you have removed peer review. Going now into very quickly some points in the project as is. Disturbed land criteria, which is very important here. What does disturbance mean? How is it defined? Is it post 5 years or post Chumash? Is it likely that disturbance could be generated prior to proposing a project just to get the project in? What is this max build-out number that we have in these big circles that have been drawn around? How do we come up with this arbitrary max build-out number? And how are cumulative impacts on a local basis worked out? The notification issue is still unaddressed, and also there appears to be no public access to initial filings. That is, under this program, if somebody wants to go in, at least there should be notification that somebody's coming in and where the parcel would be. The last thing is a sort of conflict that might be generated in the county in the desire of the program to speed things up and this issue of things like drought. We've seen in the Carrizo there's a massive drought issue, a species collapse. Will the county be conflicted between speeding somebody through, which is the intent of the program, and telling them, no, wait a year, go back until it rains and do your biological survey? I see some internal conflicts there, and obviously there needs to be some guidelines as to what constitutes a good biological survey. And very lastly, one of the speakers last time, and this came up with the Cuyama issue, there are things that might be very useful in regard to LOS-3 basins, and that is if we're trying to reduce irrigated land, then it might be quite possible that would be an important criteria for entering this program. I thought that was a very interesting comment by somebody at the last meeting. Thank you very much for your time, and allow me to go over.
Thank you very much. Following Dr. Chiffing, we have Don Legg, to be followed by Bill Waycott.
Good morning, Commission. I am Don Legg, and first I'd like to speak as a citizen, and that is that, we have an opportunity here because we do have a lot of data right now. I mean, this county has gone forward on some very large projects which were enormous and immense in complexity. And there's a lot of data coming out, and I think this is a great opportunity to be able to sort through some of the information that's coming from the projects. I think that, there's always going to be challenges. Nothing is easy, as you well know, sitting on this commission. However, as far as, my comments today are more going to be more directed from the Economic Vitality Corporation, the energy cluster. And basically, I don't think anybody's trying to speed up anything. I think people are looking for clarity. And that's the one thing that has been missing. And to have the certainty that comes from going through the process that this grant provided us, I think is very important. And in conjunction with the timing of what we already know. I think that we've got a wonderful opportunity here. I will now refer to the letter and speak for the on behalf of the Energy Cluster of the Economic Strategy Project, which is managed by the Economic Vitality Corporation. We're providing these comments and express our support for this renewable energy streamlining program. I'm going to kind of skip through. The letter has been put on record, but it's relatively long. You know, first off, is the economic part for us is that the green energy sector, specifically in energy generation, has experienced substantial growth. It's been recorded in 2013. It's been a key economic driver for head of household jobs, increased sales revenues, and all sorts of ways to strengthen our economy. But again, this streamlining program and the effort and the exercise that's been put forth here has striven to increase predictability and adding a level of certainty, allowing for the mitigation through project design rather than extremely costly and time-consuming discretionary review processes. So, understanding the concerns, and I respect always everybody who has input on these projects. But I think here we've seen that we know we can go to certain levels, and that's what this is it's providing some transparency. So for a developer, particularly those in the agriculture sector who have the ability to generate energy on their properties for their uses, I think is very important. We commend the county for defining a clear pathway for those renewable energy projects which meet the established criteria, and by establishing the separate tiers based on their facilities and project size. So there's these environmental thresholds that I think are very important, and yet they are appropriate that it's been addressed through this process here. We also like to support the benefit for agricultural producers and other landowners to allow them to aggregate their sites for energy generation purposes. And with that, I'll just note that I think on the non-reflective and the reflective regarding the large-scale solar, I think we're talking about photovoltaic solar energy as opposed to thermal, which I think what the reference here is that not mirrors, that we're not talking about mirrors, which would be a reflective type of way to generate, and photovoltaics are non-reflective, and that's what we have in the plains. Thank you.
Thank you. Bill Waycott, followed by Eric Vian.
Good morning. My name is Bill Waycott. I'm a small landowner and developing a seed business in the Napomo Mesa, and I'm a biologist by training. And I just wanted to address a couple of points here that I see as a conflict from my point of view. As a small business developer, why am I not allowed to participate in this streamlining process as these other entities are? I mean, we all have to go through a process. It was given to us for a reason, and we all respect that and believe that it should be followed because all the right insurances are put in place. Why do we need to move fast now on some of these projects when petroleum prices are at their all-time low? Natural gas is in a huge supply and also quite inexpensive. And rooftop solar is a gaining opportunity and clearly the ultimate option for all of this process down the line. From the biological side, I'm a great fan of the native plant and fauna of this state. There are roughly 6,000 species of plants in California, of which 2,000 exist in this county. This county is an amazing biological reserve, having over 30% of all the species that occur in this state. So it's clear that we have to be very careful in our assessments. The biological review that's apparently set up for this process does not have public scrutiny, as I understand it, no peer review process, and those who have the knowledge, granted biologists are trained, but there are deeper and more profound understandings of the interactions of these species and the ecosystems that exist, those people also need to be informed and allowed to review this process before decisions are made. With the increasing ability of humans to occupy the land and to develop it, our resources from the plant and animal side that existed here before we all got here are extremely rare and important to preserve. Thank you.
Thank you. Eric Byam.
Thank you, Commission. My name is Eric Viam, San Luis Obispo, a leadership team member of Slow Clean Energy. I'm speaking to you today in support of this effort. I want to thank senior staff James Caruso and the consultants. I think they're doing a great job. And I want to address a number of points for your commission. First is that we need to change our perception of aesthetic impacts. The aesthetics of solar is highly compatible with agriculture and rural communities. We're not talking about creating smoke-belching factories or long oil trains or anything like that. We're talking about installing solar vineyards and solar orchards. If we were to do a project with vineyards and orchards, the consideration about visual impact wouldn't even be in the conversation. Second, to what I spoke previously, something in this, we have an opportunity here to prioritize project to address water issues by prioritizing projects that replace irrigated lands in water basins with a level of severity 3. Please take that under consideration. Also, this creates an opportunity to diversify revenue for farmers, help keeping agriculture vital and rural economies vital and sustainable. From my perspective, the big picture here is balancing a rapid transition to clean energy to address a changing climate with protecting our natural resources. And in order to protect our natural resources, in light of the fact we have ongoing drought, increasing average temperatures, and the acidification of our oceans, this is leading to the far greater destruction of our natural resources. So the efforts taken by, recommended by staff to mitigate the impacts through the use of certified biologists to identify if there's a issue is sufficient in my mind. If there's any biological resources identified, it's kicked out of the streamlining process. And then finally, every megawatt of clean energy that we install makes a difference. And that the process here is setting a precedent that is, in essence, an act of leadership for other communities to follow. I do admire the efforts of Eric and David and the others to improve this project and to bring perspective. I think that's really critical. But the analysis done on the impact of this clean energy by Eric is flawed. Our state continues to increase the percentage of renewables that is brought onto the grid. It was 20% by 2012. It's 30% by 2020, and it's going to be 50% by 2030. What that means is that we are eliminating fossil fuels from energy use. The fact that we're ratcheting up our renewable portfolio standard is absolutely removing fossil fuel generators and is impacting greenhouse gas emissions in our state.
Thank you, Mr. Beam.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. I understand we have one more who just arrived.
Yep.
Andrew Christie.
Good morning, Commissioners. Andrew Christie, Director of Santa Lucia Chapter of the Sierra Club. The RESP states that streamlining can occur only if a biological report determines that there is no potential to find sensitive species on the site. On January 22nd, staff proposed a revision to this requirement to delete potential from the criteria so that a project could be streamlined if there is no direct presence of sensitive species on the site. We appreciate that you've been trying to find the balance between encouraging renewable energy development and protecting natural resources. We suggest this proposed change holds the potential for significant unintended consequences. In 2010, the Local Government Commission selected San Luis Obispo in which to study the local effects of climate change and recommend priority adaptation strategies. They held several workshops here and issued a report which contained this conclusion, quote, many important strongholds for threatened and endangered species are not protected and are not included in critical habitat designations. Critical habitat needs to be revisited and revised to include these areas as well as buffers for climate change range shifts. Climate change may make marginal farmland available for conversion to coastal wetlands or native grasslands. Topographic complexity provides climate change refuges for species across the county as they shift to new areas. Many areas are currently available for providing buffers and connectivity for natural ecosystems, primarily on private land, but these areas could be lost to development if new policies and approaches are not quickly instituted with climate change in mind, end quote. In other words, the potential habitat areas proposed for streamlining will be, by definition, precisely the areas that the county needs to leave undeveloped in order to implement a climate adaptation strategy. Those lands identified as potential habitat are the lands that sensitive species are most likely to need if their current forage and habitat are lost to the impacts of climate change. It would be ironic, to put it mildly, if this county, in seeking to reduce carbon emissions and the impacts of climate change, were to render impossible the adaptation to the climate change impacts we have already incurred by putting this program in place. We strongly advise you to avoid that conflict and discard the proposal to classify potential habitat for sensitive species as eligible for streamlining. Making provisions to protect endangered and threatened plants and animals and assure the continuation of their habitat is just as important to curbing the impacts of climate change as making the shift from fossil fuels to renewable energy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Christie. With that, I believe we have all the speaker slips accounted for this morning. I'd like to remind you that because of the fact that we have scheduled two major EIR matters on a single day today, we're going to have to discuss this until noon, and then in the afternoon we go to an entirely different project. And for that reason, there's another hearing that will be held on this matter February 26th. And that would present additional opportunities for public comment.
May I add to that, Mr.
Yes.
Chairman? Not really complaining, but in light of the fact that we do have another one scheduled for the end of the month, I received this on my computer and this on Friday, and I have to make a living and do some work. Impossible to read and absorb before today's hearing, so I was going to ask for a continuance to the end of the month anyway for that reason.
You don't have to, and it's okay to complain. Okay, so now back to the list of hearing discussion topics. And among the things that I had asked be included, since we kind of went through the EIR issues rather quickly, would be enough time for us to kind of work our way through the EIR issues, but also back to the nuts and bolts, or the weeds, if you will, of the actual RESP proposal. And we got partway through last time, and I'm sorry.
Sorry. Do you want to have staff respond to public?
Yeah, I think we'd let's try something like this. First, we'll get some staff responses to the comments, and then perhaps you could staff could tell us how much time is going to be needed for the actual review of the ordinance changes that we were talking about last time. Because as much as we have. Okay, all right. Well, I think that's where we left little Nell on the tracks, and so to speak. So, Mr. Caruso, would you like to do some responses, and then we'll go from there?
Sure. We can respond to the testimony we heard today, and I want to ask Bob Stark or Mr. Keith to jump in if I miss anything. Let's going to talk. A number of the comments talked about peer review of technical studies, and I think as we explained last time, we do not peer review technical studies. probably 99% of the cases. We will if there's a question, if it's a particularly controversial issue, if the study was done by someone not on the approved list. There's a whole range of reasons why a peer review would be required, but that's definitely an exception to the rule. If you want to use let's use the small solar projects, the four that we have permitted in the past couple of years. Those were all accompanied by a very, very simple biological study. They did not go as far as the biological studies that would be required in order to prove that you can go through the streamlining process. And in fact, the way that we have put the language that actually Andrew Christie was mentioning it, by taking out that word potential, remember, we need an in-season survey by a professional who's approved by the county to tell us yes or no, are there sensitive species, are there sensitive habitats on the property or not, on the site or not. If there are, then you have to go through the minor use permit process. And let's take a look at that for a second. There is an assumption out there that by going through the minor use permit process, that's going to be better or a more review or a more in-depth review than a project that's been streamlined. That's not necessarily the case. And, in fact, the more I think about it, the more I'm fairly convinced that that is not the case whatsoever. Just remember, when you go through a minor use permit, and this is what happens in the real world, is when you have a minor use permit, you are looking at individual mitigation measures for just that project. You're looking at the facts of the project. You're looking at a whole range of different facts of the case, and you might not get the mitigation measures out of a minor use permit that are as strong, and in fact, I don't think you will, as development standards you have to follow in a streamlined project. The development standards that are written in the REST for a streamlined project are much more strict than what you're going to get out of a minor use permit. That's just a fact of life. You actually have to show you don't have sensitive resources on your project site. Well, a minor use permit, they don't care. It doesn't care. You can have endangered species all over the site. You have to go through the process to ensure you're protecting them. But as we've heard from testimony, apparently that's a hit or miss question also. So I think it needs to be stated and stated quite strongly that the development standards for a site plan review of a streamlined project are much more strict than you would get out of a minor use permit. Dr. Chipping mentioned that he was okay with Tier 1. That's certainly something that the commission can consider. The disturbed land criteria is very, very specific. The disturbed land criteria cites the definition in the LUO of what a disturbed site is. And then, we have it in one of the supplemental staff reports. And Jennifer's going to find that for me because I don't remember which one it is. But it includes terms such as clearing and grubbing. I think it was Dr. Chipping asked, could someone just go out, disturb their land, and then quickly after that apply for a site plan? Streamline review, and that somehow is going to be a hole in the process. There are lots of holes in all of the processes, things that we live with every day. If people want to get around an ordinance, people will get around an ordinance. It's something that, as I said, we live with every day. In this case, though, you would have to meet the definition in the LUO of a disturbed site. If you do, that's great. You get to check that part of streamlining off. If you don't, you have to go through a minor use permit process. We've been talking about the notification issue quite a bit also. Back in the first hearing, in the table that described the differences and the similarities between the different permits, the notification of a hearing and the holding of a public hearing were the differences. What's the difference between the minor use permit and the site plan review? Your commission has talked about some type of notification. You might wish to continue that discussion. However, site plan review does not get a public hearing. There, it does not end with a public hearing. Therefore, if you're talking about notification in some way, you have to ask yourself, what are we notifying people of, and what are we telling them to do if they have an issue with it? Usually when you get a public hearing notice, it says write a letter to the plan or come to the hearing, offer testimony to the commission or the hearing officer. Well, there is that does not exist in site plan review. You have to think very, very carefully, what are we suggesting to people that they do if they receive some type of notice or they read a posting on the site? Because there's very, very little actions after that that they can take, and we need to keep that in mind. Also, Dr. Chipping mentioned that this is a very complex program. It is a complex program. One of the complexities is it's not a project. You have a complicated project this afternoon, but it's a quarry. It's something they're doing to the land. It's something that's pretty visceral. You can understand that. It's a project. Where what you're dealing with here this morning is policy. It's a program. It's changes to ordinance. It's a lot more nebulous than the project that you're dealing with today. And I think in our experience, the reason that you don't see too many people in the audience here for this program, and you'll see a full room this afternoon, is that's what people believe is important. When we ran through 18 hearings on the conservation and open space hearing about 4 years ago, I don't think we got more than 20 people cumulatively all of those hearings. It was a policy document. It was perhaps one of the most important policy documents this county has adopted in the past generation. Yet it wasn't very well attended. Why? Because it's a policy document. People don't understand the implications of policy. They don't realize how important it is. However, they do know that there's a quarry in there where they live and there's traffic on that road. That's the reason you do not see that much interest in your policy determinations that you make here at the commission. I've lost my place.
Potential?
Yeah, we can touch on potential again. We believe it's an improvement to the language because if you just leave it as potential, that leaves a interpretation open to the biologist doing it or to county staff who's reviewing it. If you take out the word potential, you have a yes-no all of a sudden question that has to be answered by the biologist. Is there one of those, I don't know how many species there are, or habitat, is there something like that on the project site, yes or no? If there isn't, then you have to ask yourself the question, then what are we worrying about? If there isn't a sensitive species, why do we continue to worry about that? Let's go ahead. If there is, then you go back through the minor use permit process, and you get another shot at trying to address those impacts you're having, the sensitive species, in a way that's consistent with your project.
Can I jump in real quick?
Yes, Mr. Keith.
Yeah, Trevor Keith with Planning and Building. So just to touch upon the biological study, we look at those internally when they come in on projects, and we do review them. And if they have any state-listed or federal-listed species, habitat for those, we do refer them out to those agencies. So I think whether we keep the word potential in or out, I think the determination is really made not at the policy level, but we're trying to make it at the staff level and working with the wildlife agencies. So again, if you're looking at something like a red-legged frog and they've got some, a pond nearby and there's foraging habitat on site, that would probably kick it out of the streamlining. So I think it's you want to look at kind of where the decision rests. And so I think that was our kind of guidance of taking it out. And I just want to touch upon we do peer review these things internally and with the wildlife agencies as well.
Mr. Irving.
Trevor, so on that sort of on that topic, I know the county has maps of Kit Fox area that may have not been reviewed or updated. They just seem to exist as a map. And when you see a Kit Fox, an area in a commercial area along Highway 101 defined as Kit Fox habitat, I mean, sure, it probably was 100 years ago. Where does a map like that fall into this? There's discussion in one of the documents about, say, the Wellsona-Stockdale Road area north of Paso Robles. I've seen maps that indicate part of that area as being Kit Fox habitat that, you know, is clearly an industrial area these days. What would happen in that case? Would that project be kicked out of this streamlined process because of an old map?
So I think, just so your commission knows, we're in the process of working with the state agency to update the map and revisit that. But to your point, I think we would look at having a biologist go out there and determine, based on the site, what the value of that habitat is, of that parcel. So again, it would still go through the process of biological review.
But it could, even though the map may exist, it could still qualify for streamlining. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's correct, yeah. Okay.
And I did want to point out that because the one sensitive species we have in the county, the kit fox, actually has a program, an existing program, where if you are impacting their habitat, you get to mitigate through...
So that would apply in this case?
Yes.
Okay.
And that's written into the RESP that's the one sensitive species you can have on your property as long as you go through the standard kit fox mitigation program.
Thank you.
I have a question along the same line. When a biologist goes out and looks at a site, what are the boundaries of the site? Is it the property ownership, or is it the location where on that ownership where the proposed facility is to be located?
We started this discussion last time. And there are two different definitions that we need to get clear. In the land use ordinance, when you're dealing with the term project site, it is a large area. It is your entire property plus any adjacent parcels in the same ownership. That's the project site. In terms of the RESP, where you see just the word site, that's the area of disturbance of the project. So when you saw those pictures of Finley, for instance, and now I don't remember I had all the acreages in my head. They leaked out. Only about, I think it was Finley, was a very small percentage of that property was actually developed in the solar project. So in that case, the site would be just that area of disturbance for the solar project. The rest of the acreage, and there was 20 or 30 more acres left over, was not part of the site.
So if there was a biological report, it would have addressed the disturbed area?
It has to be a little bit careful. You have to be a little bit careful because we would, and this is something that we would do during a pre-app meeting more than likely, is say, you know, we need that detailed survey in season of the site where you're disturbing. However, you're going to need to go outside of that because, remember, we have setbacks from sensitive species that are off-site. If you have a creek and it's on the opposite side of your parcel, you have a pretty substantial setback. So we have to know about all of those resources that perhaps not on the area of disturbance, but are on their parcel and actually an adjacent parcel. For instance, if there's a wetland on an adjacent parcel, we need to know that there's a wetland because there's a standard setback from wetlands in the program. So the important part, the detailed information, has to be on the disturbed site, but the scope of the study is going to have to be broader than that.
I think this is you've touched on a key issue here relative to the elimination of the word potential. I'd like to come back to this in our discussion. Particularly, I'd like to have you show us in the proposed changes to the regs how this is handled actually verbatim so that those of us who might be concerned about, basically the species don't know where the property boundary is, nor do they know that they're in or out of a disturbed site. And if a biologist is being told to just look at the site, then that would be of concern. So we don't have to address this right, answer this definitively right now, but I think that deserves additional commission discussion.
All right.
Mr. Irving.
James, on you did not address, I don't think, or maybe you only partially did, Mr. Christie's comment about the county's need for a climate adaptation plan. In the discussion of potential again, I don't know that you can respond to that right now, but he makes a point that things are changing, and certainly I've seen oak woodlands dying drastically because of the drought. So I think perhaps that needs to come back. With regard to the question of notification, a thought that I have also to remember to bring back. That's a very good point that you make about what is it that the public's to do. I mean, just because I put a pink sign and it says, I don't know, tier one application or whatever, however you identify it, I think at the very least the public needs to somehow be known that notified that they get to. I think that's an issue that we've got to get a handle on better. Where the public is say, I've got a solar project and it's right here. Mr. Campbell can't see it right now, but he needs to be able to know that my non-reflective panels are going to be in the viewshed of not the public, but of his living room window. I don't know how. It's a very good point you make. I mean, site plan review doesn't allow for a public hearing, but whoever is conducting that site plan review needs to know that Mr. Campbell's view will be impacted by that. We've got to work that into this, I think, somehow, because I think it's the visual that I think, as a realtor, I think that's the visual really impacts the neighborhood and the values of the neighboring properties more than almost anything.
Two responses to that, and the first is it's. Well, Mr. Campbell might be in Mr. Campbell's. We don't mean to pick on Mr. Campbell, but you started it, so it might not. It might.
Finley started it.
It might be in Mr. Campbell's view of his living room window. That does not raise it to a public issue, and we would not be looking at that. Okay. Private views are not something that the county will regulate. When you see any type of visual studies done. Always from public roads or parks, public where people congregate. It's not, it wouldn't be from someone's living room window. So regardless of that, now I should step back. It does give Mr. Campbell the opportunity to know that something is going to happen in his living room window, and maybe there is some effect he can have on the decision, perhaps. But that's as far as that.
See, that brings us back to the mup and the cup. If it came before this commission, just like Politis will this afternoon, if I don't like the view of that quarry or I don't like the view of Findlay or whatever, if I have it, it gets vetted in a public forum. And this will be one of my conclusions as we wind this thing up. All the things that are coming out here, it seems like the only answer is to let it be vetted. It takes care of the biology. It takes care of everything.
Well, and that's also assuming that that's a correct, what you're hearing in testimony is correct. And we're not ready to say that. We don't believe that simply sending out public hearing notices or even just having an opportunity for a public hearing is going to change any decision that's made, is going to make automatically have any permit review be more in-depth or perhaps better. Or to raise its quality, I don't think anybody up here believes that is a foregone conclusion.
You think it would be better handled a site plan review? I don't fully understand the physical process. A site plan review is reviewed by whom, and how does that differ from a hearing in front of a hearing officer within the planning department, such as hearing a lot line adjustment.
Right, and the process is exactly the same up until the public hearing, notice, and hearing. So when an application for a site plan review comes in, we send it out to the agencies that, just like a MUP, we make a decision which agencies would be interested in this. We send it to them, ask them for their views, their conditions of approval, any issues. Staff then has to go through the analysis of the general plan. In this case, it would be the RESP, the 22.14, the streamlining aspects, go down the checklist. Remember, an application that comes in is going to go through a very detailed application process and checklist to show that they how the applicant believes they meet these requirements. That's the same thing as a minor use permit. We don't share that with the public. We don't share the work at our desk going through the application and checking it off to make sure everything is correct. Three of the four solar projects that were the small ones that were approved had grading permits associated with them. Remember, site plans that need grading permits are subject to CEQA. So there's even a way that a small solar project can be subject to CEQA, in which case, you know, we're going to go back to that site by site, you know, the site review of biology and visual, and a lot of the streamlining might get lost there if we can't use the EIR. That negative deck goes on let's say it's a negative declaration is done. That goes on the board agenda. So Tuesday morning at the back of the board agenda, you'll notice that as all of the NDs and EIRs that came out that week. And then that's it. It's signed off by the staff person. No public hearing notices are sent out. No public hearing is held. There are conditions of approval, or can be conditions of approval of a site plan review, because the ordinance mentions including conditions of approval, for instance, from other agencies. So that one thing that's missing is that public involvement in the hearing and the public hearing notice.
Commissioner Meyer?
It's not dissimilar to form-based code in many ways, and form-based code causes the same troubles. People worry that they don't have any control over it. It's already a predetermined conclusion. The one thing you said which really struck me is that if there's a question, we go on. Bob, earlier you said, you know, when staff's reviewing the project, it's just going to flow along through the RSP's mitigation that is already set. And maybe there's a question, maybe there's not, but the public's never had a chance to put that question in. And so what we need is kind of a hybrid, basically, that allows the project applicant to use the EIR, but also allows some sort of public comment, because there may be a comment that comes from the public that says, well, you didn't notice or you forgot this one little aspect that, and everybody goes, oh, my God, we forgot that one little aspect. But if the public's never allowed to come and give that testimony, we've missed it. So if there's a public review process that also allows, it's a hybrid and it doesn't exist right now, we have to have some new combination. That's I think it's possible. We have to figure it out.
If you really believe you get some value added out of that, then that's something that perhaps
it's,
you want
to. It's not going to cost anybody any more money because they don't have to. I mean, it's going to cost a tiny bit of time, but it costs the county some money.
Well, it's adding to a process, making a long process, a difficult process, a complicated process, even more long, complicated, and difficult. For what value at the end? Is the question.
I think what Commissioner Meyer is suggesting is that there may be information value along the way that, if overlooked, is going to wind up subverting the process in the end. The outcome will be less qualitatively good than had that information been available.
Suppose it's theoretical.
Mr. Campbell.
I'd like to get back to staff's indication that having public review, et cetera, that there may not be anything come forward of succinct value. Going back to my living room view, if you were here last week, you'd have found that we approved a Verizon site in the San Miguel, there out of San Miguel, and the applicant was sitting there, and the people next door who were protesting were sitting there. We moved the thing over to help their view a little better and clean it up, and the two went out talking to each other. So there is value in listening to people.
There can be okay. Value. However, we're talking about a long-term countywide program that, as I said, if you think that you can get some value out of a notification to neighbors and something beyond that, and you think it's a positive value added to the process and to the program, then by all means, let's try to come up with something. However, what we're saying is that I think we're nibbling around the edges of this thing. We're at the margins, and we are doubtful about the result or the value added to the process of these things.
Commissioner,
just in my mind, 20 acres is basically from Santa Rosa Street right here down to just beyond Charo, and from Higuera Street from Marsh Street, rather, to Monterey Street, which is basically about half of downtown San Luis Obispo. 20 acres is Tier 1. That's a pretty big site, and if you're next door to it, it's going to make a pretty major impact.
In a city, it's a big site, yes. But in the rural area, it's not as big.
Heck, it isn't. Okay. I go by Finley's every day.
Right. I'm going to break in here. For those of you who joined us late, we're talking about the renewable energy streamlining program, which apparently has gone along somewhat under the radar for some folks, judging from the turnout we've had on comment. We are going to have to break this off in 20 minutes, and we're going to be far from over. We understand that administratively this project is on a fast track, but we do have questions as commission members. I'd like to take the remaining 20 minutes. Mr. Caruso, if you would take us back to where we left off on the actual code language we started to review at the previous hearing.
Sure. And, Mr. Chairman, before we I have some thought in my head. So we're going to be supplying you, of course, with a main staff report for the 26th and then another one of those supplemental staff reports with a even bigger than the first one. Would you like us in that supplemental staff report to address your issue here of notification and different ways it can be done and meaningfully?
Yes.
And let's do that. We'll try to get that supplemental staff report out at least a week before your hearing, hopefully longer than that, maybe a week and a half before the 26th. And we'll come up with, well, we might not have options. We might only have one idea that we between all of us, but we'll bring up something.
We'd like to know the gradations of choice.
Yeah.
On notice.
Well, yeah, okay. Trevor
Keith. That settles that.
With planning. Yeah, we'll bring forward whatever options that we have and potential costs associated with those.
Because the alternatives, other than the no project alternative, which nobody really is at least seriously considering at this point, we realize the value of some streamlining. The question is, what are you giving up in terms of information potential from the public as well as opportunity for informed consent?
Yes, I understand all your comments, and we'll bring back all options that we can come up with.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Okay, and so now what we're going to do, if you remember last hearing, we started going through on a page-by-page review of the RESP. So here's how we're going to do this. Ramona, if you could put this on the screen. This is the original RASP on the screen. And
Us the page number again? I'm sorry.
And we are on page 16 of 64, and that was attachment 4 of your January 22nd staff report. That is the RASP as it was released on November 17th. With some of the changes that we have been proposing. So we're on 16 of 64 of attachment 4 from January 22nd. And the yellow highlights represent changes. And so is everyone on 16 of 64, as we see on the screen? All right. And we started two-thirds of the way down with C, subparagraph C. That's in yellow. It was something that was changed. And I believe the change came out of the Ag Department, where they wanted to be part of that decision-making on this has to do with the ag easements when you're on important ag soils. The Ag Department wanted more detail about what an easement would have to do, what type of soil type, what type of support for agriculture. So that yellow is much more detailed than the original was. D, the next one, also
Chairman,
brings.
Yes. I need to jump in right here and actually backtrack a little bit. I'm sorry, James, but at the top of that page, I can't remember if I asked this question or not, and since Ag Department is here, item two, why the need for a different ratio of conservation easement on parcels that are other than the project site? What was the rationale there?
Good morning, Linda Okeneke from County Ag Department. And we did discuss this last time, and they're really, with the language change, if we're not talking about the a different intensity of land, there really is not a rationale for having a different ratio.
Okay.
So it could be that one-to-one offsite.
Thank you. I just needed to get myself back in the flow. Then coming back to item C, the Ag Department shall evaluate criteria. Are those criteria already defined somewhere, or is that something that is yet to be defined?
They're defined further in that paragraph where it says, including but not limited to soil capability, available water supply, existing on-site land uses, parcel size, and land use designation. Those are the criteria.
And you don't want to be, or is it impossible to be more specific, say, about the question of available water supply?
I think it's giving the Ag Department
leeway.
The ability to make the decisions on the based on the facts.
All right.
Mr. Meyer.
So is this addressing the idea that we could use Class 1 soils, given that there might be no water?
No, it's the Class 1, which we are now calling prime farmland, are always off the table. This is the important ag soils, which not including important, not including prime farmland. And in fact, it's only the highly productive rangeland soils of important ag. So this is dealing with a very narrow profile of soil type in the county.
There has been some, the reason I bring it up, there has been some discussion, though, from the public with respect to this water severity level 3, where people that have property that is formerly cropland, formerly irrigated cropland, that now is fallow and they're not able to use it, and the idea that we might be able to use that land for solar applications as long as that property is in the level 3 severity. And that was an interesting idea. That's something that the commission should discuss, because I'm sure there might be plus or minus on that.
So that's an item.
Is this the place that we should discuss that or not?
This is a complicated program that you just doubled the complexity of with that discussion. It's going to involve some agricultural issues. Remember, level of severity 3, even though there really isn't a lot of evidence right now, it should be temporary. Because when you're in a level of severity 3, just like when you're in any water problem, you're supposed to be working towards a solution. And so when Commissioner Meyer's scenario of irrigated ag land can no longer be irrigated because of the lack of water, I assume you may mean the lack of groundwater.
Well, that's how it has to be irrigated. I mean, it has to. You don't irrigate farmland from above.
Well, in the Central Valley, you do.
Ditch water.
Well, then I mean from rain. Thank you. I think
I would just leave it as available water. I don't care if
a topic that needs to be flagged for further conversation.
Okay, really.
Could you make a note of that for February 26th? I think we'll try to identify key issues before we walk out of here on this item today. But I think there is a great deal more yet to be explored publicly, judging from the questions I'm hearing coming up in my own questions. So we'll try to get as big as complete a list as possible for you next time to address. Moving right along.
Mr. Chairman, hearing you say that, it's 11:45. You need 15 minutes to establish some of those. Do you want to try to establish some of those questions or issues you want more discussion of on the 26th?
Well, Here's the reality. We started this discussion on page 16 of 64, and looking back at my notes from the 22nd, we have gone all the way from page 8 of 64 to page 16 of 64, and I can't remember a thing that we talked about.
It was okay, though.
Okay. Just being honest. And there's a lot of detail here.
Yeah.
So, yes, that we have a list of issues, but perhaps what we're going to need is a more systematic approach to get that list put together. In fact, I'm thinking that possibly we might want to send Mr. Keith and Mr. Caruso our own individual lists by email. Is that a permissible communication?
Thank you. This is Whitney McDonald from the County Council's office. I think that would definitely present an issue under the Brown Act. I think providing comments individually, perhaps.
Just to be clear, we have questions, and we often have questions before hearings that we share with staff, so to alert them that the question is coming up. I don't think anybody is talking about.
Why don't we just run through each of our quickly?
Mr. Chairman, we only have one other item for the next meeting, so we should have hopefully enough time to get to it.
Do you want to? We'll start. Mr. Irving, are you ready? Of issues.
No, I don't have them summarized in my head.
The problem.
You're hearing one to one. You're hearing me complain about this item one to one on conservation easements. The Ag Department has said that that's probably okay. I'm with Commissioner Meyer on discussing this on irrigated lands, but I have a lot of questions still about definition of disturbed soils.
Right.
I may not take the same restrictive definition of the public or of staff previously. So
I think the problem, Mr. Keith, is that we're running into a time problem with this whole process. And we understand that there are bills to pay and grant funds to pay those bills that run out at the end of March. But there's nothing in the grant that says that a process of this complex in nature has to be contained within the grant funding period other than for administrative reasons. Naturally, you want to be able to pay the bills.
Correct.
As long as the money is available. Do you have a suggested alternative to the present process, which is very crunched?
Right. I think, my thought, and see how you feel about this, is I think the two main points that came up today, kind of overarching, is really kind of the biological review piece, and then the other piece of kind of how to include the public in the process. So kind of getting back to the site plan review versus, some hybrid, as Commissioner Meyer brought up. So those are kind of the two that I think we need to get back to you with at the next hearing. And so maybe we begin with those and then start kind of walking through the language again. Because I think as we walk through the document, that's when the questions will kind of, pop out for you. And I think in my mind, we just need to see how far we get with the next hearing. On the 26th, we have one item in the morning and then the remainder of the day for this.
Perhaps individual commission members might come with a list of questions ready to ask at that time.
I got them. They're here.
I think we all do.
Right here.
Yeah, so I think unless there's another way.
I think I should actually take a step back and rephrase. I think if these are just questions that you would like to have addressed in a public hearing, then they can go to staff. We would then look to publish them essentially as comments like any other item that we receive from the public, and then come prepared to discuss them. So it wouldn't be a way for staff to be sending information back necessarily, but if you would like to convey it to staff, that would be okay.
That would be very helpful, because then we have time to collect our wits and and communicate our concerns in a way that allows people time to respond efficiently.
So does that...
So I guess individual commission members are invited to send their questions to staff, to Mr. Caruso. And that will give you a chance to organize a set of responses around overlapping questions. Some will overlap, others will be outliers, and you can do, you can organize it both ways. And then we will want to continue, I think, even though it's hard to retain this, we will want to continue going through the actual ordinance language change, because I'd remind those of you who haven't been following this blow for blow, this is an actual change of zoning. It's a change of the land use code to create a combining designation, which is a zone. And last time we talked about where is this zone going to be, and we went through that to some extent. And I don't remember the exact resolution of how the mapping, the generalized mapping that we have presently is going to be made more specific, so they would, so people would know whether they're in or out of this new combining designation. But combining designations, to some extent, are they're ways to handle special problems and issues, but they also are somewhat invisible from a public perspective. And so we want to make sure that the limits of the combining designation geographically are known before an ordinance change to RE is executed. And I forgot where we left off on that issue, Mr. Caruso. You're going to do some extra mapping for us. But my question, okay, so you can add this to my list right now. How does a person know whether they're in or out of the combining designation?
And we did touch on this last time. But,
And when will people know whether they're in or out? And where would they go? They would go to the, maybe to the website. Mm-hmm. But there are probably limits on the level, the scale of input for different components of this combining designation. So some input levels, for example, distance from a substation. That's fairly definitive. You can measure that precisely. Mm-hmm. But then some of the, say, the Kitfok designation, I don't know how precise that is in relation to property boundaries.
Right. And we'll have a response to that. And but just the short answer is all of these mapping layers are GIS mapping layers.
Right. Right,
and that's what our maps are based on.
Right, and GIS
another layer.
Maps usually have varying levels of scale input. In other words, some are at so many hundred feet to the inch, and others are at a much grosser scale.
Right, and we've had a little bit of discussion about this, about mapping. The line is going to be, for instance, we'll be able to tell that a boundary of an RE goes through a middle of a parcel.
Yeah.
So it'll be at that scale.
Okay, so people with property interests and or biological interests will know where these boundaries, where these edges are in relation to sites.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Any other
point.
Any other questions for the staff? We're getting close to, yes.
We have a few minutes. We have 3 minutes left, and I brought something up privately with you. Is it 12 o'clock we break or 12:30?
12.
I brought something up privately, and we have 3 minutes. Maybe we could talk about the idea that open space is in chapter, that one, table four.
Right. So Commissioner Meyer mentioned this yesterday, and we took a look into it, and we do have to make a little change. There are two zoning categories, open space and recreation, where tiers are not allowed, and there was a mistake made. There is, in one of those matrix boxes under open space, it has an A2 designation. Yes. For tier one in open space. That's not correct. The only type of solar electric facility allowed, actually in open space, there's nothing going to be allowed. Right. Because open spaces are, we take open space seriously in this county. It's for the protection of resources. It's on the recreation side that there tiers are not allowed on recreation zoning, but solar accessory are allowed. And the reason is, in both cases, recreation and open space, the purpose and character statements or the purposes of these designations are not compatible with 20 or 30 acres of solar facilities. On the rec, though, we have golf courses that are zoned rec. And even though you're not going to put a tier one there, because that's not the purpose of it, you should be able to put it up on your roof or a ground-mounted, small ground-mounted, to run your facility. So that's what Commissioner Meyer pointed out, and we are in the process of correcting that.
Good. I'd flag that also.
So any other questions? Okay, what we're basically saying is that in addition to the issues that have been identified in the last few minutes, we would appreciate the commission members taking the time to identify the issues and or questions that they have that they would like to have addressed at the February 26 meeting, for which there should be plenty of time to go through somehow systematically in addition to the remainder of the ordinance changes. Mr. Crusoe, do you have any wisdom to share with us on this procedure? Any last words?
We want to help the commission get through this. And yeah. So we'll have questions, which we'll have answers for. The other thing is, if we have the time, what we'd like to do is go through the sections of the program that you're going to be reviewing and maybe flagging some issues for you.
That'd be good.
Maybe explaining some things that might answer some of your questions up front.
Yeah.
If we have the time and we have the energy, we'll get that done like a week. Everything needs to be done a week before the hearing to give you an opportunity to read this. So we'll take a shot at that too. To try to head off any questions.
Okay. We do appreciate all the care which has been taken in trying to move this program forward, both by staff and by consultants. And we understand you've been living with this much longer than we have, and that's the perhaps part of the difficulty in trying to reconcile that time gap in a relatively short, confined remaining time. So we'll have to play it by ear and see how far we get. We hope that we can be conclusive, if possible, on the 26th. And with that, I think we need a motion to continue this or to the 26th, Madam Secretary. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so...
So moved.
Okay, and we have a second.
I'll second.
Okay, and Ramona, would you please?
Commissioner Irving?
Yes.
Commissioner Meyer?
Yes.
Commissioner Harrison?
Yes.
Commissioner Campbell?
Yes.
Chairman Topping?
Yes, and we'll break for lunch. We'll be back at 1:30 with Las Palitas.